bachelor's degree in English.
Mm.
Hello, and welcome back to Canuck is a Slur, the show about cool and cursed Canadian culture. My name's Nicole, and joining me today is Kelly. He's just a tag along. I did all the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm reading Nicole's script, obviously. She's pretending to be surprised by everything in it. I mean, I am skipping over all of the like very problematic slurs and like weird screeds about poor people that she wrote in here. But other than that, okay, so you're going to lay on the mouse pad? Okay.
Yeah, she's a cat, of course.
In the all cats are girls sense?
Yes. Oh, okay. Is she not a cat?
He's a man.
Oh, sorry. His name is Peaches, so we don't need to have gendered names for cats, but
just out of camera shot.
Always.
He's like doing a Mission Impossible thing. He's like just out of the camera edge at every moment.
Nailing it. So cute. So today we've been started talking about Tim Horton, and then we went on a tangent about every hockey player who has ever died and killed people in alcohol-related car crashes.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, so the last episode was horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're going to talk about...
good stuff, nice stuff.
Good.
Yeah.
Good, nice stuff, like Ron Joyce and what an upstanding citizen he is.
That's right. Yeah, so this part is about Ron Joyce Sr. And I'm just going to try to read around the cat. Joyce's life before he become... You're making noise.
Oh, but it's so cute.
I know it is.
Come here, Momo.
I mean, okay. I was going to say, you can just vamp about stuff and I'll mute my mic so we can watch it. There you go. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Yeah. Ron Joyce's life before he becomes involved with Tim Hortons is not particularly interesting, in my opinion. He did serve in the Canadian Navy, which allowed him to see a fair chunk of the world, but I only bring it up in order to read this snippet from his memoir, the auspiciously named Always Fresh. Quote, "We also traveled to India and Pakistan during the time when the two countries were being partitioned, and I witnessed firsthand the amazing influx of refugees between the two countries." This is just me talking here. I don't know if you know anything about the partition of India, but I think this is a little bit of an understatement, considering the 1947 partition of the country is one of the biggest human-made humanitarian crises in history.
Oh, Jesus. Is he going to go on to discuss how important it is to avoid these things and the importance of caring for... refugees or
no, he just kind of blows past it.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get another quote from him, but first we're quoting from the Harvard Gazette on the partition itself. Instead of the 14.5 million thought to have moved from country to country in previous estimates, Leaning and colleagues said up to 18 million may have moved, and between 2.3 and 3.2 million likely died in the violence. Research published in 2008 by Bharadwaj Kajwa and Atif Mian reached similar conclusions, saying there were 17.8 million migrants and 3.4 million killed. Now, perhaps it's a bit unfair to expect Ron Joyce to have grasped the magnitude of what was going on at the time from his limited on-the-ground perspective. Maybe he's just speaking to what he happened to see. I'll read the rest of the passage and you decide.
Oh no.
Quote, "Due to the tremendous number of refugees in Karachi, Pakistan, the country was busy building makeshift homes. They would simply take two long concrete block walls that were divided by further concrete partitions approximately every 20 feet. The space would become shelter for the refugees, who then had to build roofs to protect themselves from the elements. The poverty was occasionally overwhelming, but the trip provided an opportunity to see a wide variety of cultures."
Okay.
Yeah, it's very like, isn't that wild? They have to like build ersatz roofs so they don't get like heat stroke or rained on. It's just very like touristy. It's again, yeah. This is not the worst crime, but it's just very like, to me, it's just a very like of that era and type of person to be like, whoa, it sure was fascinating to see all this like misery.
Yeah, the humanitarian crisis gets an honorable mention in the story of his trip to India and Pakistan.
Yeah, that's kind of where I land on it. And again, maybe this is nothing interesting. Maybe I'm just grasping at straws here, but...
No, that's not for chewing on.
Probably...
That's also not for chewing on.
No, don't chew on that. Probably a general indifference to human suffering is not going to come up again in this story. Let's move on. For his next career, Joyce became a cop.
Oh, boy.
Like Horton, he had his hands in a number of jobs through the late 50s and early 60s, and one of his first successes came from becoming a Dairy Queen franchisee in 1963. Joyce loves to wax on in his memoir about growing up poor and working hard to get ahead, so let's use the inflation calculator to put this business in 2024 terms. To own your own Dairy Queen at this time, you needed to put down just under $2,000 in 2024 dollars. You needed to put down just under $2,000 up front. The total cost, which you had your entire first year to pay off, was a little bit shy of $79,000. Joyce was enticed by an old Navy shipmate who... Not from Old Navy. Joyce was enticed by an old Navy shipmate who described the store as, quote, a license to print money, and he wasn't wrong. He claims his store, so Joyce claims his store made a profit of nearly $148,000. I believe that is $2,024 again, in those first 12 months. So he got a whole year to pay off like $80,000 and he made about $150,000 in profit.
And you only needed $2,000 to start it up.
$2,000 deposit, yeah.
Anyone could have started the DQ franchise then. Yeah. Like that's like $2,000 is like, I mean.
That's like what we pay rent on this house.
Yeah.
In a month.
That's Jesus.
There's no good way to say exactly how much credit Joyce ought to get for his location doing well. He does mention, quote, solid support from a couple hired employees as one of the reasons for the profits. And for what it's worth, he still did apparently have enough free time to continue working as a police officer. For their part, the Dairy Queen head office provided all the equipment and did not charge their franchisees any royalties. Joyce is more than happy to say that corporate in this instance was very fair, and any franchisees who had issues with them were making ridiculous demands, in his words. Again, there's not enough information here to know the truth, but I do think that Joyce has a lot of incentive to paint the other owners as unreasonable in their disputes with Dairy Queen HQ, as he himself writes, quote, in a few years, I would face a similar problem, but with a twist. I would be the corporate entity that a group of franchise owners would form an association to challenge. Joyce's depiction of this association of franchisees is rather telling, quote, it reminded me of a union meeting. I didn't care for the dictatorial terms of unions when I was an employee. I felt I should be able to determine what was in my best interests.
I wonder if this is actually his opinion at the time.
Right.
I always wonder that when people say things like that, when they're like, oh, I never cared for safety nets, social safety nets. I knew that I could make it on my own. And it's like, okay, but did you actually think that at the time, or do you just think that now because you're a fucking millionaire, billionaire douchebag?
Yeah, maybe. I feel like in this case, like, you don't have to look far usually to find people who are like in a more working class thing that are like, mar, 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 unions. Like, it is kind of just like baseline conservatism. And so
that's fair.
Again, maybe this is just his retelling, but like, it sounded like he actually was standing in opposition to the people that were actually like associating as owners. Like, that's what he was at least bragging that he was doing that. He was like, oh, yeah, like, I wouldn't like join these people in their. In their crusade at all, so.
That's, I have PTSD from that Elon Musk thing where he was talking about how he doesn't believe in unions because unions create this peasant lord complex. That,
oh,
like,
yeah.
And you're like, shut the fuck up, dude. God. Like, you don't think the peasant lord complex comes from the fact that you have, like, basically complete power over someone's life if you're employing them, and that you, like, you have all this fucking money and these people are just scrounging to get by and they have to just do what you say?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if that's going to come up later.
Yeah. I keep saying I have PTSD, but for the record, I do not.
Okay. I mean, no, when it comes to stuff Elon Musk says, I honestly feel like it gets very close. Like, I just... By 1965, Joyce wanted to acquire a second Dairy Queen, but had trouble finding backers. To make a long story short, he ended up taking a chance on franchising through the upstart Tim Hortons Donuts, again spelled Do-Nuts, Do-Nut December, instead. This didn't involve dealing with Horton directly at all. This was done entirely through Horton's original business partner we briefly mentioned, Jim Charade. Joyce quit his job.
Was it real?
Yeah.
We have no idea.
My name's Tom Scams. Like,
okay. That's like from that Dungeons and Daddies episode, the character whose name is Scam Likely.
Yeah, exactly. He's a real life Scam Likely, Jim Charade. Jim Charade is what I do when I pretend to wipe the benches down after I'm lifting. I'm kidding. I've never lifted in my life. Joyce quit his job with the Hamilton police to focus on the donut shop and described some pretty typical growing pains as far as a new food service business. I think this passage from Always Fresh stands out. Quote, for someone who has never baked, it is quite a difficult thing to learn. You have to work by feel. Heat and humidity affect everything you do. Even after you think everything is figured out, the weather could change and you are back where you started from, struggling to make a consistent product. This was the challenge we faced with our bakers or our production people, especially in the early years. How do you teach them to make a great product when a lot of it is done by feel? A good baker simply knew a good donut from a poor one. And good bakers were hard to come by in the early days. Once a store operator located someone who worked out, They were often poached by other stores. It got so bad that we had to institute a rule within the chain that said no one could steal someone else's baker, end quote.
Okay. So they worked it out within the industry, like a no poaching rule.
No, poached by other Tim Hortons franchise
locations. Oh, okay. How are you able to poach? Because they're franchises, so they probably have like a standard wage. How are you able to poach other people's bakers?
The wages are not standard. That will come up.
Oh, okay.
Because when you're a franchise owner, again, it depends, because like Wendy's deal, it was Dairy Queen that he was working with, like their arrangement was different than Tim Hortons, and especially with what Tim Hortons would become.
Mm.
You definitely, like, there's a lot of devolved decision making to store owners. So like, yeah, no, you could absolutely like fuck over somebody, even though they work for like the same company technically.
Mm.
Or they're under the same brand at least.
Right. I guess if he's anti-union, he's probably pro people finding ways to make their franchise location better.
I mean, like he said it was a problem. So at least like it wasn't a rule. And then they put in a rule that said like, no, you cannot take bakers from other people. So.
Right. Okay.
If you know where this story is going, you might have found that prose about good bakers to be very depressing. If you don't know where the story ends up going, stick with us and you're going to be very depressed.
Is it that the donuts suck now?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So he goes on to describe training bakers as, quote, labor-intensive and time-consuming, end quote, demonstrating either Joyce's or his ghostwriter's mastery of the literary technique of foreshadowing. To explain how Ron Joyce became the co-partner instead of Jim Sherrade, we get to play another fun guessing game. From the moment Ron bought the first Tim Hortons location, how long do you think it took for fraud to enter the story?
Oh, God. Less than a year.
The answer is 3 weeks, and maybe not by who you'd think.
It was not Jim Sherrade? Sherrade?
Okay, yes, it was.
Of course it was.
But it wasn't Ron Joyce.
Scam likely.
So the concise version is this. According to Joyce, the police showed up to seize equipment that had not been paid for, which shocked him as he could prove he'd purchased it outright. It turned out that while he'd bought the equipment from Horton and Sherrade, they had merely been leasing it themselves and evidently not making all the payments.
Oh no.
Yeah. Horton, to his credit, apparently acknowledges that this is a problem. He suggests that these kinds of issues are because they don't have enough capital going into the business. Sherrade didn't have the resources to do this, so through one mechanism or another, he was soon out of the business, and Tim transferred that half of the shares to Lori, his wife.
Okay, sorry, I totally zonked for that one.
Okay. Tim Horton is like, okay, the reason we're doing this like fraudulent shit is because we don't have enough capital. We need more capital in the company.
Right.
I can bring more capital to the company. Jim Sherrade cannot. So Sherrade is like half owner of the business. Tim Horton just transfers Jim Sherrade's shares to his wife, Lori.
Right.
The story of where the capital came from then definitely bears mentioning. This is from The Athletic. Quote, Horton's full NHL salary went to Tim Horton's donuts, and then he and Joyce were paid equal salaries from the company. The details of this arrangement were not disclosed to Horton's wife until much later.
Oh, boy.
When I did find out, Lori wrote in a book years later, I was furious.
Yeah. Like, he just single-handedly decides for the entire household what happens with the income?
Yeah.
And so he pumped his entire salary into the company,
mm-hmm.
and then he paid himself out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, yeah, that article doesn't specify exactly, like, when the scheme started.
Yeah.
But it just said it was in place for, like, the back half of his career, is their wording.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's reasonable to infer that he set this up probably right then in 1965 to get more money flowing into the business.
Mm-hmm.
I think that also, like, you can kind of read into that as this is why he kept demanding more salary to play one more year, and why he kept playing one more year, because he was like, well, this is $100,000 that goes straight to my business.
Of course.
And then I'll just get paid like, you know, $10,000 or whatever the fuck.
I need to keep doing this until like my business is profitable enough to do it on its own.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
I also meant to mention, like, I didn't get a chance to read Lori Horton's book. I would like to hear the other perspective, because we are going to quote a lot from Joyce's book. And I mean, yeah, we'll get there.
Okay.
Lori Horton's book, In Loving Memory, is in that stupid limbo where you can't buy it anywhere digitally or physically, but Google Books will allow you to only read a preview of its fully digitized copy. However, that preview does include one photo caption that absolutely needs to be included. Quote, this is on our honeymoon in Daytona Beach, and Tim washing his 52 Mercury. He'd had a 1949 Mercury, but driving home from Sudbury the summer before, Tim was diddling with the radio dial and drove it into a pile of rocks. Stop letting Tim Horton drive! So, this creates a logistical problem, as Jim Sherrade had been the one to handle the actual operational side of basically everything. So Joy slid in to fill that donut hole.
Hey.
And it didn't take him long to work out that this wasn't a great deal for him. So he tried to negotiate a stake in the company. After a long back and forth, which included Joyce threatening to back out of the business entirely, Horton finally caved in the fall of 1966, and a deal was finalized by the end of the year, in which Horton transferred the other half of the shares back away from Lori and over to Ron Joyce, who was more than happy to throw a little shade at her in his book. Quote, "It turned out that Lori had grown quite fond of being half owner of the business, even though she had nothing to do with it. It took Tim quite a while to convince her that it would be best to turn over her stake to me."
Wow. Jesus.
He is such a little cunt.
Of course she liked being half owner. She couldn't trust her husband to fucking like tell her anything about the money. So like, she's like, at least my name's on it. I have some sort of control.
Yeah. I don't know what like year she learned that this was happening, but. Oh. So in addition to getting Lori Horton out of the company, Joyce had another goal, getting Tim Horton out of the company. He placed a lot of value on branding, and while Jim Sherrod had thought that using the famous hockey star's likeness in their stores and signage would be good for business.
I see where this conspiracy theory is coming from.
Yeah, so like they had all this, like everything was blue and white, like the Maple Leafs, and they had like pictures of Tim Horton in the shop and stuff like that. Because originally that's why people went to the store, was because it was like, why I should go to this new chain. We're like, oh, I love Tim Horton. He's like the big star for Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Joyce placed a lot of value on branding. And while Jim Sherrod had thought that using the famous hockey star's likeness in their stores and signage would be good for business, Joyce had a different opinion, as he explains in Always Fresh. Quote, "To me, I don't care what we call the business, but it has to have broader appeal than simply relying on hockey," I told him during one of our discussions on the business and its marketing. "If you want to call it Tim Hortons, that's fine because it's a great name. And I don't think Miles Gilbert Hortons would fly, but we can't continue with the hockey image."
What?
So Horton acceded to Joyce's demands, and the latter continued to handle all the meaningful logistics. To show the starkness of this contrast, we'll examine the two men's approach to baking. Here's Joyce from his memoir. Quote, "Freshness was my mantra, but it was difficult to find employees willing to start work in the wee hours. I had gotten the baking down to a science and could make dozens of donuts by myself, but that resulted in another complication. Lacking my experience, trainees had to start earlier to make the same amount of product. Besides which, it was hot, difficult work that few were willing to undertake," end quote. So compare that with this quote from Horton to a journalist who interviewed him in the early 70s. Quote, "Ron took me aside for a week and tried to teach me, but I got burned all to hell. Baking donuts is worse than fighting in a war."
Oh boy, I wonder if maybe Joyce told him that, because Joyce was actually in the military.
Well, but like he did, it is agreed that he tries it. So like Joyce describes in his memoir, like Tim Horton, like burning himself with oil, like trying to do this, Jesus. Doing badly at it. Part of why I do not believe that Tim Horton invented the apple fritter, like.
He fucking couldn't even be in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Joyce did most of the boots on the groundwork, but Horton could be something of a problem solver himself. When a new store was being built with a different layout, Joyce was horrified to learn the equipment order hadn't been altered to match. So he called his new partner to express his frustrations. And from the book again, "I told you to ensure our fixture people flipped the plans," I said over the phone before going into some detail about how upset I was. Tim paused for a moment before answering. Then he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do, Ron. I'll drive down to the Skyway Bridge and jump off, or I can order new equipment. What do you think I should do?" It was just an example of how he could bring perspective to any crisis.
Okay.
Sure, Ron.
Jesus.
All right, this is back to me. By their powers combined, the business slowly but surely expanded. There are a handful of amusing anecdotes in this period, like the one where Joyce and Horton meet with a prospective business partner who keeps yelling buy or sell into a bank of phones, who they turn down, and that guy later gets busted for fraud. Or the mysterious customer who Coles calls Joyce up at home and asks him when the chain will be expanding to Calgary. And he's like, yeah, then I hung up and wondered how the guy got my number.
Oh boy.
Or letting his brother, a franchisee, sell coffee and donuts to a Navy ship without paying royalties to the company. But not much is very interesting. He also gives a slightly different version of the time he tried to teach Horton how to bake. According to Joyce, he told his partner it would take 2 weeks to learn properly, and foolishly gave one of the bakers 2 weeks off. Horton repeatedly burned himself with hot oil the first night, was mocked by the Maple Leafs teammates he'd brought with him on the second night, and simply didn't show up for the third.
He brought people in to watch him learn how to bake donuts?
Yeah, his teammates who loved him.
Okay.
He's like, you've seen me barricade an intersection with cement barrels and watch me burn myself with donut oil.
I guess, yeah. Maybe if you think that this guy can like lift oil barrels over his head, you're just hanging around to see what crazy thing he's going to do.
Yeah. And he does it very poorly. He's just trying to do donuts by brute force. Just, rah! Yeah. Because, like, I think if I remember, the way he described it was, like, you have to hold, like, these racks just so. And instead, he, like, held it at an angle, and it just, like, poured down his forearms.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess if you have a whole entourage that's, like, following you around, that's got to be super embarrassing. No wonder he didn't come back for night three.
As the book goes on, Joyce spends many pages tediously describing the business arrangements that were part of the spread of the business to more and more locations in the country. However, he occasionally mixes it up by taking a few paragraphs to completely slag off Lori Horton. Early in the text, when Joyce is corroborating the Tim helping Lori use the gas pedal story, he claims that, quote...
Helping.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, that was my wording.
Okay.
He claims that, quote, Lori would often get upset with him when he appeared to be having too much fun, end quote.
He got upset with Tim, or she got upset with Ron?
Ron Joyce said, Lori would often get upset with Tim when he appeared to be having too much fun.
Yeah, that's the thing with Tim, is he was always having, he was just a fun guy. Yeah. He was just having so much fun getting hammered and driving 200 kilometers an hour. Yeah. And his wife was just that, like, oh, you shouldn't do that.
Oh, Tim, you're going to kill us. Yeah.
Oh, what a bitch.
So as Joyce gets to describing the last year of Tim's life, he labels the Horton's marriage beyond difficult, suggests she held back his hockey career, and calls her a liability and an attention seeker.
She held back his hockey career.
Yeah, his Hall of Fame hockey career.
His Hall of Fame hockey career.
He played for 24 seasons.
Yeah, in the NHL, where he played until he was 44 and then he died horribly due to his own actions. Yeah. That was all her fault.
Yeah.
What a fucking prick.
He also alleges that she, quote, had a problem with amphetamines and other medications, end quote. And on one occasion, after everyone but Lori had left the Horton's home or a friend's place after a very tense visit, she'd let the air out of Tim's, Ron's, and their friend's tires.
Was it because they were going to drive home drunk?
They'd already gone to someone else's house. Oh. And then he's like, I think he said, like, we went out the next day and all of our tires were deflated, like, at this other house.
I mean, to be fair, I feel like I probably wouldn't stay with my husband if he had a history of drinking and driving. But if I was like, there's a chance he could come home and then drive this car, I'd be like, okay, well.
Yeah.
I don't know what her reasoning was, but I can't see her as the bad guy yet. I'll have to have more evidence than she let the air out of her tires.
None of this can really be proven true or false, but given that he spends at least as many words on the Horton's marriage as he does on Tim's death, one thing is clear, Ron Joyce did not like Lori Horton.
What an asshole. Why did he even have to bring her into it?
Well, okay, there's a tangible reason we'll get there.
Okay.
As you may know, in early 1974, Tim Horton died in a tragic car accident.
What?
Yeah.
Shocking.
No one knows why. Joyce describes himself as very upset, so much that it took him, quote, a few minutes for me to get my emotions under control.
Oh my god.
That was longer than the guy on the ice. That guy was probably like a minute that he was sad.
And the emotion he was trying to get under control was the absolute excitement that he was now going to be able to shoehorn his way into being the main person in the business.
Yeah. Or maybe a few minutes in like the telltale heart way, he's getting rid of his guilt over having murdered Tim Horton.
Maybe. That took more than a few minutes, though.
I'll bleep out that accusation.
I was actually going to make the comparison of, like, when you're watching a show and, like, someone, like, murders someone else and then they, like, get their emotions under control in the way that they, like, hype themselves up so they can call 911 and sound like they're being accurate or being horrified at what's happened instead of...
Yeah. Like the performative shock, yeah.
So that's what he meant by getting his emotions under control.
Yeah. Wipes the blood off the knife and calls 911.
Yeah.
My friend, he's bleeding for some reason. I mean, he wasn't killed with a knife, but... But yeah, he had priorities to attend to, namely getting the message out to franchise owners and assuring them that very little would change operationally. Joyce immediately segues into accusing Lori Horton of being insufficiently emotional about her husband's death. Then he explains...
Wow!
Yeah, then he explains that he went to St. Catharines, quote, to gather his personal effects. It was a part of a gentleman's agreement between Tim and me. If either of us died suddenly, the surviving partner would destroy any personal items that might cause embarrassment to the family.
So this is like the equivalent of like, can you delete my browser history if I die?
Yeah, it's exactly that. Also, like, hey, one of us might die suddenly.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think about that sometimes. Like, if Ryan and I both died horribly in an accident, I'm like, please don't let my mother be the person to clean out my, apartment.
I wonder whose idea that was. Like, hey, Tim, it'd be a real shame if you died suddenly.
Yeah.
And we should plan for that.
Yeah.
Whatever you may think of such an arrangement, Joyce makes it clear exactly how he felt about honoring it. He goes straight into explaining what it was that would be so embarrassing to Tim Horton.
What?
He had been having an affair.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So yeah, he reveals in his book, oh yeah, Tim Horton was having an affair. The very next sentence in the book is, quote, years after Tim's death, Laurie spent much of her time and money partying, end quote. He also tells Tim's oldest daughter, Jerry Lynn, about the alleged affair. You may also not be shocked to hear that Joyce does not have anything kind to say about Laurie as a businesswoman.
What a guy.
He says she'd never been employed outside the home.
Oh.
Which is, yeah, not only like very 1970s, but also she was credited a bunch of things as like she used to be like an ice dancer. So like kind of a lot of the same qualifications Tim Horton had to run into business.
Yeah.
Like, you did ice sports. And then you became a business person.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, this is like also another classic, like people not recognizing unpaid labor as labor. Like she like ran a household and like she, I mean, it sounds like she maybe didn't have as much say in the financials because she didn't realize that her husband was like pumping all of their money into a business and then only paying himself like a small salary.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Anyways, still, that's very like, yes, you're right. Tim Horton had the same amount of qualifications as she does, and he's still, yeah, okay,
cool. So fortunately for Ron Joyce, he and Horton had apparently formalized a business structure that had a token amount of shares held in trust by a mutual friend to be transferred to the surviving business partner if one of them died, guaranteeing either of them majority control in such an event.
Oh, boy.
So it was like, I think it was like 200 shares of the company. And then like he and Tim Horton each had 98 shares. And then like 4 shares were held by a friend. So when Tim Horton's dies, this like clause kicks in and he's got like 102 shares to her 98 or something like that.
Okay.
Majority control, though, was not enough for Ron Joyce. He spends many pages on all the thoughtful, selfless reasons he couldn't continue running the business with Laurie. And then, the man who spilled so much ink on how bad he thought the Hortons' marriage was and how unhealthy Laurie's lifestyle was, casually drops that his second wife left him at this point, taking all their children and leaving no contact information or forwarding addresses. Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, literally. He puts that right in the book. He's like, yep, they did not allow me to reach them.
And
that's his second divorce, to be clear.
Yeah, I guess he's an expert in bad marriages, so he's the guy to talk to about other people's.
And then he collapses in the parking lot of Tim Horton's headquarters.
Collapses out of
Like exhaustion or something. Like,
Oh, yeah, of course. It wouldn't be emotion. It only takes him a couple minutes to get. I wonder how long. It only took him a couple minutes to get over Tim Horton's death. I wonder how long it took him to get over his wife and children leaving him suddenly without leaving a note.
not long.
Maybe it took him a handful of minutes, not just a few.
Mm-hmm. In an insightful person's memoir, this might be the part where they impart some meaningful lesson from this, or it becomes a watershed moment for how they live their life. In Ron Joyce's memoir, he shrugs and spends several more pages going on about the valuation of the company for the purposes of buying out Laurie Horton.
Good Lord.
Yeah, because he's like, I was overworked and like this like led to the dissolution of my marriage and caused me to have like a medical event. Anyway, business was doing great.
How was reading this book? This book sounds like...
So I didn't think I was going to read this book. I didn't think there was going to be a Ron Joyce episode. I was like, there'll be an episode on the guy, an episode on the business.
Mm-hmm.
And then I added the Tim Horton hat trick. And then I was like, oh, I can get a PDF of Ron Joyce's book. Let's look at a little bit of it. And then so much of it is like this. A lot of it is just boring business shit, but a lot of it is like, why would you write that?
It waffles back and forth between shitting on Laurie Horton and talking about how important the business was.
So I'm not a business guy.
It's a business.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you what the actual value of half of Tim Hortons was in 1975, but these are kind of the bullet points I've worked out what happens next. So the accounting company Pricewaterhouse evaluates the company to be worth $1.7 million in 1975 money. So the offer is made to buy her out for half of that, $850K.
Okay.
So Ron finds him a bank to lend him $850K. Laurie gets a savvy lawyer who jumps the asking price to $1 million even, like quite late in negotiations. Ron is upset by this, but he finds funds to cover the rest. Once everything is signed, he mansplains banks to Laurie because he wouldn't want her to miss out on a few days of interest. Yeah, so basically it's like almost Christmas and he's like, okay, it's like Friday or whatever. Like, we better get to the bank and cash this, Laurie. Otherwise, you'll have to wait a whole week and we want you to get interest on this money. It's so patronizing.
Good Lord.
So immediately after the deal goes through, the bank injects another $1 million of capital into the business.
Okay.
So the bank that he borrowed money from is like, yeah, your business is worth, like, I don't know how much, I should probably have looked up how businesses work. But I don't know if like adding $1 million in just like straight liquid capital increases your value by $1 million. But basically a bank lends him money to buy her out. It's like, well, this is what the company's worth. And then immediately after he buys her out, the bank is like, well, now here's $1 million like on your $1.7 million company because we believe in your company now.
Okay.
So I feel like there's a little bit of, it feels greasy to me. It feels very slimy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that basically that cost him nothing to buy her out.
Yeah, like, I mean, he still had to, like, lend, borrow the money. But, like, Ron Joyce ends up becoming a billionaire. So yeah. In any case, it works out for him. But it's very much like, well, I gave her what the business was worth. And the business became worth at least a little bit more, like, right after. It gives me no pleasure to be fair to Ron Joyce, but for the sake of accuracy, I would like to offer two clarifications. First, according to Joyce, it was fully the bank that approached him after the sale with the offer of more money. Second, it was a $1 million line of credit, so more along the lines of a loan rather than an investment. And it seems like it would be pretty hard to pin down how much this would actually have affected the valuation. Regardless, I still think he's a dirtbag. So I want to take a quick second, since he has such strong opinions about Lori's business acumen, to read this blurb where he describes his own lawyer. The deal was finally signed on Tuesday, December 23rd, 1975. There was one last problem. We arrived early in the morning and it became apparent that my lawyer hadn't really been capable of overseeing this sort of transaction. It turned out it was simply too large for him and most of his paperwork was out of order and had to be redone. Alan Pyle, the banker funding Joyce's takeover, who came to the closing with us, was sick with the flu and had to struggle along as all of the official documents for the closing were redone. He suggested that my lawyer was not very competent.
Okay.
So Joyce closes off the story by describing how happy he thinks she looks and affirms their continued friendship. At first.
But, okay.
Because he's like, yeah, we used to go to like dinners and events together after.
Yeah, I mean, based on what he's said about her in his book, I can't imagine that friendship did continue.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Okay.
He ends the chapter with the line, unfortunately, neither our friendship nor her money would last.
Oh,
now that's writing.
This guy.
So turning back the clock again, not long after Captain Hanson Gregory took credit for punching the middle out of the donut, people worked out pretty quickly that it made more sense to just craft a purpose-built ring-shaped donut. For a long time, that's just the way donuts were. There are stories floating out there about how people had punched out the center and tried to use the dough in various ways, like re-rolling it into base material for more donuts, but machines making the prefab ring donut have been around for a long time, dating back to the first machine built by a Russian immigrant named Adolf Levitt back in the 1920s. And you can tell it's an early 20th century story because you still have Jewish people named Adolf.
Yep. Checks out.
It wouldn't be until the 1970s that one innovative company would make a concerted attempt at specifically marketing a so-called donut hole as its own bite-sized treat. And that company, of course, was Dunkin' Donuts. Dunkin' themselves claimed that their product did come about as a result of punching out dough from the center of a donut proper. Whatever the case, Dunkin' first released their new product in 1973. They sold poorly when branded as donut holes, but extremely well when sold as munchkins and marketed to kids.
Mm.
Tim Hortons clearly learned from this example, launching their own version in 1976 called Timbits, presumably named after the bits of Tim that were spread across the Toronto-bound lanes of the QEW years earlier.
No, I hate that you made that joke.
go ahead.
I just like even the image of those people walking along that like part of the highway and like picking up the pieces of his car and stuff.
Yeah,
and, like,
the little Timbits, the bits of Tim's car.
Fuck's sakes.
There is possibly nothing in the world more boring than reading a businessman writing about interest rates, but it's occasionally worth it for a paragraph like this in a context where he's talking about obtaining his pilot's license and flying around on business. Quote, I remember having another issue flying in the early years of the company, though this one had nothing to do with weather. On this occasion, I was flying Tim and Dick Trainer.
Dick Trainer?
Dick Trainer.
This guy's name is Dick Trainer.
Dick Trainer.
Cool. Good. Normal name.
Oh, my God. there's quite a few amazing names in here, and I compiled the ones that aren't like directly quoted at the end. Mm. So on this occasion, I was flying Tim and Dick Trainer, a close associate of the two of us back from Sudbury. Both Tim and Dick had consumed a few drinks before and during the flight. And after we took off, Tim decided he was going to fly the airplane just as we were over top Ken Garrippy's cottage at Hockley Valley in Orangeville.
Oh my God.
He took the stick and made several wild movements. I quickly took control of the plane from him, but I don't think he realized the moments of terror we experienced with his maneuvers.
I mean, that checks out for Tim Horton. Tim Leadfoot Horton. I don't know how to, like, say the horror of what happened with his wife in the car in a, like, a cutesy nickname, but that checks out.
It would be so much funnier if he killed himself in a plane crash from trying to take over when he didn't have his pilot's license and he was wasted.
Yeah, that would be very, like, 1960s pilot, like, or, like, 1960s flight story.
Yeah.
I guess it was 70s.
There's literally no vehicle he will not get into and just, like, nearly fly into a ditch.
Yeah, absolutely.
He tries to get his car in the air and his plane's on the ground. Anyway, Joyce reaches a point where he's an unequivocally successful businessman. He's upgraded to a private corporate jet, which he picks up himself, performing a series of elaborate maneuvers in the air. Upon landing, he notes that while it should have been a highlight of his life, he fell into a depression instead. Why did he feel so empty? He'd run the company for 20 years and expanded to 250 stores. What was there left to do, he wonders in his memoir. Could this be the moment Ron Joyce finally grapples with the yawning emptiness of capitalism, the insatiable void that only grows larger with more consumption?
Oh my God, does he start another business?
This was Ron Joyce's dark night of the soul. When he emerged on the other side several months later, he realized at last that he needed a meaningful goal for once, and he'd finally hit upon the answer. Open 1,000 stores.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Buddy.
Yeah. Literally, he's like, wow, I felt so empty. I knew I had to open 1,000. Then I would feel good.
I feel like it makes sense that they were friends, because I feel like the way that Ron Joyce approaches business is the way that Tim Horton approached driving cars and drinking.
And it's just never enough.
Yeah. And also his NHL career.
Yeah. It's like driving 150K isn't making me feel good. What if I drove 175K? Yeah. Then I'll feel good.
You think he went up in increments of 25? I was thinking 10.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Well, we'll never know. He didn't keep a diary that we know of.
Yeah.
If he did keep a diary, then Ron Joyce would have published it.
Yeah. He would have went, taken it from his house, and then published it later.
So, I didn't really write this part in, but it was really interesting to me where when Ron Joyce describes, like, walking in on Tim, and it's like, oh, like, Tim was with, like, a new lover, and they looked so happy and said that they were both going to leave their spouses for each other, and I was, like, excited for that to happen. And I feel like for a, like, old shitty boomer like Ron Joyce, I feel like they don't use gender-neutral terms like that on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, is he, like, kind of, like, tiptoeing around the fact that, like, Tim Horton was with a dude? Like, that's pure speculation on my part, but it was just so odd. I was like, there's a few mentions of this person, this, like, completely non-described person that he catches Tim Horton with, and he just, like, does not say anything to suggest it's a woman. And I'm like, that feels like such a specific thing for, like, an old guy in the 90s to be writing that way. But I don't know. Like, again, that's reckless speculation, but it was just very, like, I got really hung up on it.
I mean, if that was the case, it would make a little more sense, the weird vendetta he has against Lori and, like, the fact that he can't stop talking about how shitty their marriage was. Like, if you saw your friend and you knew that they were, like, in a marriage that wasn't fulfilling them, I guess even if he did have a male lover, that doesn't mean that he was gay. He could have been bi, but
yeah,
or pan or whatever, but it's... I can understand a little bit more why you would have such a vendetta against your friend's marriage if you were like,
yeah,
their marriage is a lie and they are unhappy. But yeah, I get vibes from this guy that he just is a fucking...
He's just a dick.
Yeah, I can't see him. I don't know. I can't see him being super woke and being like, my buddy was gay and I was happy for it. But
well, I feel like that's why... So, like, again, on Tim Horton's end, like, it's not really our business, like, whose lover was or what his, like, preferences or his orientation was. But from Ron Joyce's perspective, I'm like, I feel like you're the kind of guy that, like, if you found out your friend was a closeted gay person, then you would, like, not mention that because that part is shameful to you.
Mm.
But I don't know. Like, again, that's so off the deep end with speculation, but it just struck me as an odd piece of writing the way it was written.
Mm. Interesting.
But truly, we're not here to read about the expansion of Ron Joyce's donut empire. We're here to read about how much Ron Joyce hates Lori Horton. Quote, however, her relationship with the chain and with me personally began to deteriorate in the early 1980s. Though her financial position was not entirely clear, it was becoming apparent the money she had received from the sale of her family stake in the chain, a total of $1 million, was starting to dwindle. That was quite surprising considering that it had been set up to make her comfortable for life. Coming from the guy who's like, oh, I gotta go buy a private jet.
Yeah.
So this is followed by an extensive shaming of Lori Horton's alleged drug use that contains such detailed accusations that I suspect it might be potentially defamatory just for me to read it aloud. And if it is true, it's so profoundly mean-spirited that I genuinely feel like it would be a bummer to dignify it with a reading.
Yeah.
So a funny thing happened, which is that I read that section. I wrote that line I just wrote to you. And then I kept reading. There's a reason that Ron Joyce introduced this topic, and that is it was the entire basis of Lori Horton's lawsuit against him. Instead of continuing to slog through the next chapter or so, let's turn to a very concise summary from Can Culture magazine. So this is an external source.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing a timeline. So 1987, Lori Horton sued Joyce and the lawyer that represented her in the 1975 sale of Tim Hortons. And this was the one who was competent, the one who got her more money.
Okay.
So she sues Joyce and her own lawyer, claiming she was mentally incompetent at the time of the sale due to her addiction to amphetamine and alcohol.
Oh.
Horton wanted her half of the company back for $10 million. However, her lawsuit failed in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
So it bears repeating here. Legally speaking, Ron Joyce had to make the case that Lori Horton was not out of her mind on drugs when he bought her out. He simply goes out of his way to explicitly depict her as out of her mind on drugs, beginning directly after the deal went through.
Okay.
So in court, it was like, no, she was extremely mentally like competent and fit. And I think he like testifies like, I never saw her on drugs. And then after the sale in the book, he's like, she was on so many drugs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fucking guy.
But it's like that literally, this is why I want to read her book. And I wish I'd had the time to, but I was like, well, I want to hear her story of her version of events here.
We'll have to do a follow-up episode after you read it.
We didn't need more stuff to read today. That's for sure. Beyond this, the legalities here are way outside my depth, but from what I can tell, Ron Joyce is a huge dick, and that's not technically illegal, but it doesn't ever seem like Lori Horton ever had a leg to stand on in court. She dies in 2000 of an unspecified heart problem at age 68, and strikes me as kind of a tragic figure at best, but it also just sort of feels like everyone involved here kind of just sucks on some level.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we didn't really get to read her side, but the way that Ron Joyce describes their marriage is like, it really feels like one of those examples where just like two people that are just very kind of shitty, like find each other.
Mm.
Like, you know, maybe they had similar energies, like Tim and Lori specifically. Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think she did have a lot going on for sure. So,
yeah.
But yeah, like, yeah. I just don't think I would have wanted to hang out with any of these people is what I'm saying.
Yeah, fair. I would challenge his like depiction of her as this like crazy harpy that wouldn't let her husband do anything. Cause it's like, it sounds like her husband was fucking irresponsible,
a psycho,
and a piece of shit.
Tried to kill people with cars and planes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, so like, oh, but he didn't want, she wouldn't let him have any fun. Well, like fun is grabbing the controls of your plane. It's not that fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what's particularly intriguing about this long-running drama between the two of them is something I neglected to mention up to this point. They were also in-laws.
What? How?
It's not clear exactly when, but at some point during all this, Joyce's eldest son, Ron Joyce Jr., married Tim Horton's eldest daughter, Jerry Lynn, thus cementing a sort of Julio-Claudian dynasty of Canadian donut royalty.
Oh, no.
If you think I'm joking, please bask in the following reporting from the Globe and Mail in June of 2023. Quote, in a letter sent to fellow franchisees in April, Jerry Horton Joyce announced her retirement effective May 31st. She owned three Tim Hortons locations in Cobourg, Ontario, and one in nearby Colborne, Ontario. In a statement, Tim Hortons president Axel Schwan confirmed that Ms. Horton Joyce had transferred her restaurants to a family member, quote, and in addition to other extended family members who are current franchisees, this means that these important family legacies with the Tim Hortons brand will continue. End of both quotes.
Jesus.
Yeah.
They are really writing about it like you would write about that. You would read about the royal family.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very much pastry royalty.
It's an important legacy.
Yeah.
Like, it's just fucking rich people.
Oh, buddy. Just wait. Before we get there, we have to rid ourselves of Ron Joyce first. And thankfully, nearly everything from here on out is too boring to bother with. At one point, the same man who described how underwhelmed he was doing emergency dives in a private jet describes riding in the back of a car with George H.W. Bush as, quote, one of the great thrills of my life.
Okay.
But more importantly, he orchestrates a deal to sell Tim Hortons to Wendy's in 1995. Joyce spends multiple chapters on a thesis about how Tim Hortons is an amazing, robust company and Wendy's is largely just a steaming pile of dog shit. Which is funny. Ron doesn't do anything interesting for the rest of the book, which comes out in 2006, as evidenced by the extremely unfortunate passage about his cool new friend Conrad Black. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't do anything interesting for the rest of his life. Like any respectable billionaire boomer businessman, Joyce would need to hit one more important milestone.
Hold on. More stores. More businesses. More money. He's a billionaire.
No, it's not a business thing.
Oh, okay. He finds his wife.
The answer is a public accusation of sexual impropriety.
Of course. I was thinking, yeah, I was thinking way too like direct to him, but obviously it should have been.
Yeah.
That should have been an obvious one.
Yeah.
Sex pest. Classic. Yeah.
This would be another baffling and convoluted legal battle, which the Globe and Mail does its best to explain in 2016. Quote, in her statement of claim, the woman, in her mid-30s, alleges Joyce sexually assaulted her at his home in Burlington, Ontario on May 19, 2011. The pair had known each other for a decade and, for one period, had an intimate relationship. Later that year, Joyce sent a $50,000 check to her lawyer on which he wrote her name and the words, account paid in full. Joyce argued that... Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Joyce argued the check was the result of an amicable settlement over the alleged assault, and she resumed a platonic relationship with Joyce, who's now 85. The woman who had a pen or a penchant for secretly recording their private conversations argued the check was reimbursement for her legal fees. Mm. So, like, his version of the story is like, oh, yeah, like, this was an amicable payoff for an alleged assault. And she's like, oh, no, no, he agreed to pay off my legal fees.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So I want you to brace yourself.
Okay.
So, yeah, this is the quote from the judge. I'm going to read it in what I think is the most appropriate voice. Apart from concluding that both Mr. Joyce and the woman are vulpine and cunning, and for the purposes of deciding this summary judgment motion, I need not decide who is the hunter or who is the fox.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
What a fucking... What?
That is... I had to, like... For time, I was like, we could read this entire article. The whole article, the judge talks like that.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It's one of these examples of the judge being like, both of you are psychos. Yeah. Like, you're both awful.
But he's writing that like he's like a 1700s nobleman.
Yeah. Vulpine and cunning.
Vulpine and cunning.
Now, also, if you're saying who is the hunter and who is the fox, but you're saying both of them are vulpine, you're saying both they're both the fox.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
That's what vulpine means, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it's also...
Or are they saying that the hunter usually is foxy? To catch a fox, you must be a fox.
Well, he's saying, like, they're equal parts those things, so, like, it's hard to distinguish who is more one and not more the other.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
The gist of the whole ordeal is that the courts ended up ruling that the plaintiff suit would go ahead, and then the news articles suddenly drop off, probably because Ron Joyce died in 2019 at the age of 88. So, rest in peace.
Yeah. Good. Okay.
Now, the accusations against Ron Joyce should not be confused with the accusations against his son, Stephen Joyce.
No.
Different son. Stephen Joyce of violently assaulting a woman both physically and sexually on a luxury mega yacht owned by his father.
Okay.
That incident occurred in 2014.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I didn't like put in any excerpts from that article, but it was one of those things where like, again, this is always bad and horrible, but it was one of those ones where the violence of it is shocking. It's a particularly bad description of like assaulting someone. It's rough.
Aww.
Anyway, that sucks.
Fucking hate rich people.
Yeah. There's nothing constructive to say there. So moving on. For all his faults, Ron Joyce did get one thing right in his life. His distaste for the direction Tim Hortons went in after he sold it.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the deal went through on January 1st, 1996, Joyce had pulled off his lifelong ambition of opening 1,000 stores, and he felt confident leaving his legacy in the warm, loving embrace of Dave Thomas. This has no real relevance to our story, but I think it's a neat piece of trivia that Wendy's founder, Dave Thomas, got his start as a Kentucky Fried Chicken franchisee.
Oh.
Did you know this?
No.
Here's a bit from MASH.com on the time he got put in charge of four struggling locations. Quote, a number of Thomas's innovations, though, helped turn those four Ohio KFCs around. He simplified the menu and came up with a classic rotating red bucket sign. Thomas also convinced the Colonel to appear in TV ads for Kentucky Fried Chicken, advice Thomas would take himself for Wendy's.
Were they required to wear those outfits, or
obviously,
he just did it for funsies?
Oh, I feel like this was Dave Thomas's idea.
Yeah, that makes sense. He seems like a fucking...
He invented the rotating bucket. I always thought that was neat. Thomas's success enabled him to sell his stake in the four franchises back to the Colonel for $1.5 million. He used the money to open his first Wendy's in Columbus, Ohio in 1969.
Okay.
Anyway, trivia.
Mm-hmm.
Joyce's actual departure from the company, Tim Hortons, came with the sale of most of his stock and his resignation as senior chairman in 2001, a very apt year considering this was essentially the time of Canadian 9/11, in that our modern history is so often divided into before and after this event. I'm referring, of course, to Tim Hortons' switch from fresh baked to frozen donuts.
Yeah.
Do you remember this?
No, but I heard about
it. No one does.
Yeah.
But you were old enough to eat fresh baked donuts at Tim Hortons.
Okay.
But that's for part four.
Okay.
So how did you enjoy Ron Joyce?
So, I mean, it makes sense that he's a corporate douchebag. My initial thing about him was I was going to yell at the fact that he let Tim get into that car.
Mm-hmm. Which we still should.
We still should. Because, like, a lot of people I know have gone to lengths to make sure that our friends, like, we have physically restrained a friend who was trying to drive drunk. Like, my brother has gotten into multiple fights. Like, and, like, my brother also being drunk. Like, yeah, I'm not saying everyone should get into fights, but my brother has gotten into multiple fights to stop people from driving drunk. And this guy was like,
yeah.
Lates, get into your fast car. Yeah.
But like this, I think this being the 1970s, again, this is reckless speculation. I've never, I have no kind of proof of this, but these are like two dudes staying up till 4 a.m. in the 70s. And he's like, oh yeah, like Tim had a drink, but like not enough to get drunk. And I'm like, I don't think Ron Joyce was drinking water. So I'm not saying he was like anywhere near Tim like Horton's level or anything, but I'm like, I bet you Ron Joyce had a few drinks and drove home himself. If I was a betting person.
Yeah, no, that's, you're probably true. You're probably right there. I wouldn't, you're saying you think that Ron Joyce, your conspiracy theory is that Ron Joyce like killed Tim Horton.
Yeah, for legal purposes, that's a joke. But, yeah. You know, maybe he spiked his drink. Maybe he, you know, did cut the brakes on his car and he paid off the cops. Like we can iron out the details of the conspiracy later.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, so my thing was, I was like, maybe there is a conspiracy, but maybe he didn't go so far as to like do anything. But like even the act of getting drunk with a friend and then letting them drive off in their sports car. When you know
they like to drive fast. It's like Batman. He doesn't save the guy from the crashing train. He's like, yeah. I don't have to kill you, but I don't have to save your life either.
Yeah, exactly. It's not terrible odds that your friend is going to die horribly when they drive 200 kilometers an hour and they're fucking hammered.
Or so maybe like, Tim is like, oh, man, I got to crash. Like, I can't crash. Like, I got to go to sleep, man. I'm too drunk. And he's like, no. You're so good, Tim. You can make it.
Yeah.
I will enjoy your shares of the company.
Yeah. Regardless of whether or not the intention was there, the effect was still the same. And I do think that like, if you don't, like, I do feel like there's still some culpability there for this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was part three. Yeah. Thanks for joining me again. And for everyone listening, check out more of this show. Check us out on, get on our Discord, support our Patreon, get some cool bonus content. And yeah, you got anything to plug?
No.
Do you have any PSAs?
Any PSAs? Don't drink and drive and stop your friends from drinking and driving, for the love of God.
Yeah. And if you don't have your pilot's license, don't grab the stick.
Yeah. And don't slander your friends' wives after they die. And don't publish your friend. Like, don't like pretend that you're trying to cover up your friends' dirty secrets and then immediately publish them.
When you have a specific pact not to share each other's secrets. And then you tell the world, we had a pact to burn each other's secrets. Here's what they were.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's the end of the episode. Bye. Je m'en calise.
Born Under Punches is a collaborative effort between me, Kelly Gomo, and a variety of contributors to create a variety of shows. If you want to support the project, you can do so by following us and our friends on our various socials. Check out the episode description for all the relevant links, especially this one. Patreon.com/pornunderpunches. No E in punches. By supporting us on Patreon, you can enable this show to sustain itself and produce regular episodes. Join at the basic tier for expanded access to our Discord server, donate at an elevated level for monthly bonus content, or even fund us at the highest amount. And once a month, I will draw anything you ask me to on an index card. And hey, if money's an object, word of mouth goes a long, long way.
She loves the Stanley Cup. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go! Listen to what I say. Play that game the Canadian way. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go!
Any sources used in the episode you just heard can also be found in the description. This content was primarily produced in Amiskwetsiwaska'ikan, in the traditional territory of the Nahiwak, Nakota, Nitsitapi, Mikawe, Métis, and other nations, also known as Edmonton, Alberta, in Western Treaty 6 territory. Thanks for listening, and happy trails to you.